Circuses on the air.
The president does it.
Sometimes you feel like
that means that it is not illegal.
Sometimes you
tear down this wall.
Here's Jennings.
Hey, Luke. May the force be with you.
It was you, Kristen, who shot J.R.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
We're not gay. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
John's been waiting a long time to take the reins.
My name is Dave Letterman. Last night, I became a father. Thank you very much.
Today, Apple is going to reinvent the phone.
George W. Bush, and I approve this message.
For the third time in 6 seasons, it's one ball cheese. The Chicago Blackhawks win the Stanley Cup. The Blackhawks win the Stanley Cup.
It's in time, and the Chicago Cubs win the World Series. The Cubs have done it.
And now, this is history.
You're going to need outstanding hosts.
With Dave Plyer.
It's a guy, but I love you.
And Dave Schwann on 720 WGN.
And good morning to you, Mr. Dave Schwann.
Well, good morning, Mr. Dave Plyer.
How are you, pal?
Doing well.
Excellent.
Doing well. We get into August already.
Yes, we do. And the heat begins.
We had heat.
It was toasty.
Yes, we did. This is August dog day heat.
It is dog day heat.
Yeah.
I've got so much in history. I'm going to jump right in, Dave.
Let's go.
The Purple Heart, 1782. General George Washington, the commander in chief of the Continental Army, created the badge for military merit. I guess that's what it was called at first.
Mm-hmm.
Consisting of a purple shaped piece of silk edged with a narrow binding of silver with the word merit stitched across the face. In silver, badge was to be presented to soldiers for any singularly meritorious action and permitted its wearer to pass guards and sentinels without challenge. The honoree's name and regiment were also inscribed in a book of merit.
Hmm.
Now, about it.
Pretty big book by now.
It was, yeah. But in 1846, after a decade of debate on how to best spend a bequest left to America by an obscure scientist, James K. Polk's... Oh, no. What happened here? I went to a whole different thing here, Dave. The hell, I was so excited.
Page 2.
The Book of Merit was forgotten until 1927.
Thank you, Paul.
When General Charles Summerall, the U.S. Army Chief of Staff, sent an unsuccessful draft bill to Congress to revive the badge of military merit. So somehow in the 1800s, it just kind of fell to the wayside.
And what's the connection with Chicago, with the Purple Heart?
What is the connection?
Dave, do you know? The other day?
I don't, actually.
A former WGN broadcaster and also newspaper writer and TV host, Irv Kupcinet.
Purple Heart winner?
No. Every year,
he
held a cruise on Lake Michigan all the Purple Heart winners.
That's right. And it was
cool.
You didn't know that?
No, I guess.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, it was the biggest thing in town.
Yeah, it was a and it had a benefit for his son, I think, or somebody like that.
That's cool.
Yeah. When I was working at Gloria Jean's Coffee, we became involved. We started supplying coffee and coffee makers for the veterans hospitals, the waiting rooms. And that's how we got involved with Purple Heart Cruise.
Boy, I forgot all about that.
Yeah.
Thanks for jogging the memory.
Mm-hmm. Look at that. Yeah. It was, though, on Washington's 200th birthday, on his bicentennial, that Douglas MacArthur reinstated the Order of the Purple Heart.
Ah,
and I had my grandfather's in a case.
Ah, yes.
He was wounded in France in World War II.
Hmm.
Let's see here. 1846, after a decade of debate about how to best spend a bequest left to America by an obscure English scientist, President James Polk signed the Smithsonian Institution Act into law. It was an act. So in 1829, James Smithson died in Italy, leaving behind a will with a footnote. In the event that his only nephew died without any heirs, Smithson agreed that the whole of his estate would go to the United States of America to found at Washington under the name of the Smithsonian Institution, an establishment for the increase and diffusion of knowledge. Smithson's curious bequest to a country that he had never visited aroused significant attention on both sides of the Atlantic.
Hmm.
And that's how it happened.
Hence the name Smithsonian.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. 1914, the first electric traffic signal was put into place in the corner of Euclid and East 105th in Cleveland, Ohio in 1914.
Can you imagine?
In 1914.
And they still have traffic problems there. I'm telling you.
On that corner.
Yeah.
In the earliest days, navigating America's roads was a chaotic experience with pedestrians, bicycles, horses, streetcars, all competing. Think about that. It was like the crossing of everything we were using over a 40-year period.
Oh, sure. Have you ever seen the 19th century pictures of Chicago, State Street, Dearborn, Michigan?
Yeah.
Chaos.
Chaos. Absolute chaos. The problem was alleviated somewhat with the gradual disappearance of horse-drawn carriages, but even after World War I, it had become clear that the system of regulations was necessary to keep traffic moving and reduce. It was a heavy number of accidents that were happening, obviously, on the road.
Because mm-hmm.
there was no one stopped.
No guidance. No guidance at all. No rules of the road.
1945, this week, at 8:16 a.m. Japanese time, an American B-29 bomber, the Enola Gay, dropped the world's first atom bomb over the city of Hiroshima. Approximately 80,000 people were killed as a direct result of the blast, and another 35,000 injured. At least another 60,000 would be dead by the end of the year with the effects of the fallout. And here is an original news report of that event.
This tale of two cities of a desert morning. Atomic age is born. A scientific thunderbolt gives a preview of its destructive force.
Was that it? Is that all we had there? Okay. All right. Yeah, that was a newsreel. That was on a record, obviously. But yeah, Harry S. Truman, discouraged by the Japanese response to a conference demand for unconditional surrender, made the decision to use the atom bomb to end the war in order to prevent what he predicted would be a much greater loss of life if the U.S.
were to invade Tokyo.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right. 1962. On August 5th, 1962, movie actress Marilyn Monroe is found dead in her home in Los Angeles. She was discovered lying nude on her bed, face down, with a telephone in one hand, empty bottle of pills prescribed to treat her depression were littered around the room. After a brief investigation, L.A. police concluded her death was caused by a self-administered overdose of sedative drugs and that the mode of death is probable suicide. Of course, there's all kinds of other stories.
All kinds of stories.
Including the Kennedy family having something to do with that, obviously, because there was obviously a rampant affair going on between the two of them as well, right?
Yeah. It's amazing that she still is the stuff of legend. And what is equally amazing is if you watch the films that she's in, I guess because she is the stuff of legend, they still hold your attention.
Yeah. Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, How to Marry a Millionaire, There's No Business Like Show Business, The Seven-Year Itch,
Busta.
And the subject of the original Candle in the Wind by Elton John.
That's right.
Oh, yes.
That's right.
Yeah.
But now, you know, she's been gone 53 years?
56 years.
56 years already.
None of us are mathematicians.
No, I guess not. Here's a news report from what happened on that day.
Marilyn Monroe, the golden girl of Hollywood, leaves behind a glittering and tragic legend. Presentation to the Queen of England was but one climax in a life that began drearily as an unwanted child and ended in a lonely, self-inflicted death 36 years later. A queen in her own realm of entertainment, she was the only woman known the world over by her two initials. A tour of army bases in Korea in 1954 brought GIs the beauty and vivacity that made her an undisputed symbol in her time. As soldiers adored her, so did men wherever in the world her films were played, and that was everywhere.
Here's something relatively interesting.
Two
decades after the fact, Monroe's housekeeper, Eunice Murray, announced for the first time that the attorney general had visited Marilyn on the night of her death and quarreled with her, but the reliability of these and other statements made by Murray are questionable. But she remains one of the top 10 like celebrities still making money, dead celebrities.
Is that right?
Like in the top 10, which is
crazy. And her last movie co-star was?
Clark Gable.
You got it.
Clark Gable.
In Misfits?
Yep.
Yeah.
Is that what it was?
Yeah.
Was that a year before her death, or was that the year of?
I can't remember the exact year, but I do remember it was her last movie.
It was her last movie.
Okay. And he was pretty well moved on, too.
Yeah.
Clark Gable,
by that point.
You're being diplomatic.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. 1973, the nostalgic teen coming-of-age movie American Graffiti, directed and written by co-written by George Lucas, opened in theaters, set in California in the summer of 62. And we were just talking earlier in the show about what our favorite summer movies were, and this was one of the top ones, of course. Nominated for 5 Academy Awards, including Best Director, Best Picture, launched the big screen careers of Richard Dreyfuss and Harrison Ford, as well as Ron Howard, you know, after Opie. You know, this was his next big project.
Was this, let's see, American Graffiti was before or during Happy Days?
It was before.
Happy Days kind of grew out of this.
Okay.
Yeah, it was Grease. You know, they we talked about this, I think, last week or the week before that there was a pilot done for Happy Days, and then they shelved it, aired it on Love American Style. Then Grease hit Broadway. American Graffiti hit theaters. And the ABC came back and said, where was that thing you did, that little pilot? And they brought Happy Days back.
Yeah, around.
And Happy Days around.
Worked for him, didn't it?
It did. Here is, and of course, this really brought back Wolfman Jack to a lot of homes as well, hearing his voice, because he's prominent through the whole movie, not only.
Right.
When I think about that, it took place in 62. This was in 73. So now we look at it 40-plus years later as, you know, a good throwback movie to the late 50s, early 60s. But at the time that it aired, that was only 10 years ago.
Yeah.
You know?
15 years.
For the most part.
I know. Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah. It seems like every 20 years, there's the cycle. In other words, the 90s are becoming nostalgic now. I can't believe that.
Let's take a little listen to the original, what do you call it? The a little original promo for the movie.
American Graffiti. Where were you in 62?
Grab that special one and jump into your candy-colored custom or your screaming machine, cruise downtown and catch American Graffiti.
American Graffiti?
Baby, what's that?
It's a movie.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
Go back in time.
Where were you in 62?
Is that you in that beautiful car? Jeez, what a waste of machinery.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight.
What did you say?
Someone wants me. Someone roaming the streets wants me.
I think that was Suzanne Summers.
It was.
Right? It was her first screen appearance.
Yeah, and she had a speaking role, but you never saw her speaking.
No, right.
And it was very short. And what was she driving?
Ooh, boy, look at you. I don't know. What car was it?
It was a Thunderbird.
A Thunderbird.
Yeah.
Look at that. I want to watch that movie now. It's 1974. U.S. President Richard Nixon announced he'll resign from his office. It was on August 9th. Let's take a listen.
To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my body. But as president, I must put the interests of America first. America needs a full-time president and a full-time Congress, particularly at this time with problems we face at home and abroad, to continue to fight through the months ahead for my personal vindication. Would almost totally absorb the time and attention of both the President and the Congress in a period when our entire focus should be on the great issues of peace abroad and prosperity without inflation at home. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
I have to assume that he knew that he was going to be pardoned, that Gerald Ford was going to take over for him, and there must have been a conversation.
There's been talk to this day that there was a conversation about it.
Yeah.
Ford, all through the rest of his life, denied it.
Yeah.
Said there was no deal, you know, just as plain spoken as he was. But there's talk that, you know, when he made the decision. And a few days prior to his resignation, people like Barry Goldwater and others, you know, conservative, you know, staunch Republican leaders came to him and said, Mr. President, you now have no confidence in Congress. It's over.
Yeah.
But there's been talk all along that when Ford became president, wasn't much later that he did pardon him unconditionally.
Which then I have to think, too, that it was not to distract the country any further. That was the purpose of his resignation, obviously.
Yes.
Was to, and to probably prevent himself from being
prosecuted. Prosecuted and indicted, yes. Yeah.
1981, on August 5th, is that today? That is today.
Today, yeah, it's August 5th.
President Ronald Reagan began firing 11,359 air traffic controllers striking in violation of his order to have them return to work.
PATCO.
Yeah.
Government cannot close down the assembly line. It has to provide without interruption the protective services which are government's reason for being. It was in recognition of this that the Congress passed a law forbidding strikes by government employees against the public safety. Let me read the solemn oath taken by each of these employees, the sworn affidavit when they accepted their jobs. I am not participating in any strike against the government of the United States or any agency thereof, and I will not so participate while an employee of the government of the United States or any agency thereof. It is for this reason that I must tell those who fail to report for duty this morning, they are in violation of the law. And if they do not report for work within 48 hours, they have forfeited their jobs and will be terminated.
You're out of here. That's what he's saying. I love that. He was pissed.
Yeah.
You could tell.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And that happened, it was in
81.
That is correct.
Yeah.
1988, the first ever night game in professional baseball took place nearly 60 years earlier on May 2nd, 1930, when a Des Moines, Iowa team hosted Wichita for a Western League game. The match drew 12,000 people at the time. And here we are in the major leagues. For 74 seasons, the Cubs only played day games at home. And finally, on August 8th, 1988... Ooh, it's an anniversary. The Cubs played the Philadelphia Phillies in the park's first night game.
Yeah, 30 years.
Yep. 91-year-old Cubs fan Harry Grossman was chosen to turn on the lights, and after counting to three, he flipped the switch and announced, "Let there be light." I believe Jack Brickhouse did this. Let's take a listen.
Did. I'm Jack Brickhouse, and I'll be your master of ceremonies for this historic first game at night ever to be played at Wrigley Field. Now at this time, we direct your attention to the on-deck circle next to the Philadelphia Phillies dugout as the Wrigley Field lights will be officially turned on. Now, to perform the honors, the Cubs are proud to have a true die-hard Cubs fan. At the age of 91, he perhaps is the oldest Cubs season ticket holder. In fact, he has been in attendance at just about every Cubs home game for the last 25 years.
We should try to get him on the show.
His first Cub game he saw in 1906 at the age of 8 when the Cubs and the White Sox played in the World Series. Ladies and gentlemen, here tonight, age 91, to officially turn on the lights at Wrigley Field is Cubs fan Harry Grossman. Harry, welcome.
And the rest is history. We'll be right back.